Thank you for downloading this programme from BBC Radio 4. For more information, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Hello.
Oh, hello. Is that Kate Saunders?
It is, yeah.
Oh, hello. My name's Jolyon Jenkins. I work for BBC Radio. I'm phoning you because I'm making a programme about internet crime, and I think that maybe your credit card has been hacked or was hacked quite recently.
Kate Saunders' private banking details are posted all over the internet. Her credit card number, including the three-digit CVV security number, her address, her phone number, her mobile number, her email address. In dozens of open internet forums, this data and details of other hacking victims is being used by criminals to entice in buyers of more compromised credit cards. "Contact me now," says one. "I will have more CVV good for you. I don't talk more. I only want Liberty Reserve," in other words, a kind of electronic money. Luckily, Kate spotted the fact that her account had been hacked before too much money could be withdrawn, and she cancelled her credit card. But she didn't know about the forums.
When you called me, I had no idea at all. It was a complete shock. My name's not exactly rare, but my email address is, and when I put that in Google, it came up with websites that had all my details on. I didn't realise that there was websites that would just have people's details so readily available like that.
But if you look at some of those sites, there are people with even more details revealed.
Yeah, when I had a look, one person's details that's got, like, the security questions that they use, the mother's maiden name or pet's name, that kind of thing, it's got those details on there as well, which is, you know, they've got access to everything with that kind of thing.
If you want a sign of how serious cybercrime has become, take a look at the opposition. Pretty much any time you can find a conference or a trade fair going on somewhere in the world devoted to computer security. It's an industry that's mushroomed in the last 20 years, and it threatens to overtake the Chinese People's Liberation Army as the biggest employer on earth. I've come to the vast e-crime congress in London, hundreds of delegates listening to presentations that deliver uniformly bad news about the remorseless rise of so-called malware, software designed to steal your money.
I'm Malcolm Marshall, partner in charge of information protection at KPMG.
If there was one thing, one message that you wanted to give...
We're no longer doing enough to fight e-crime. The tools we have are not sufficient to fight the threats we're going to be facing in the future. One of the antivirus companies monitors the number of new malware attacks, and that has increased by almost six times between 2006 and 2007. So there are now over 7,500 new malware programs launched every day, which is actually more than there are good software programs launched every day. We're not losing the battle yet, but there is a really big risk that we will lose the battle in the next 12 months.
The trouble is that this is all second-hand, and the security industry has got an interest in talking up the risk. So I want to experience some computer crime for myself, and one place to start seems to be the people who are posting Kate Saunders and other people's credit card details. To Mr. Bad Dog, "Hi, are you selling fresh UK CVV2s with DOB and address? Click send." While I wait for Mr. Bad Dog to reply, I want to talk to a reformed hacker, Matthew Bevan. Back in 1997, he was charged with hacking into American military computers, although the charges were dropped. He's an old-school hacker who had complex psychological and personal reasons for doing what he did.
I was really ostracised by my peers at school. You know, I was bullied and teased and really felt very powerless. Yet, in the world of computer systems and this whole cyber world, to get wrapped up in that, you know, you could really feel that you were somebody. And there was an ethic about how you went about hacking these machines. You know, you'd try not to interfere with the machine. You wouldn't just go and crash it. You'd just try and go in and out, and just as a test. And as we've seen over the last few years, I wouldn't say that these sort of criminal gangs are groups of hackers. I would say they are criminals who are using hacker techniques. You know, they're just concerned with money.
Mr. Bad Dog has replied, "Yes, bro. CVV UK plus DOB equals $15 for one, but if you buy 50 CVV, I will give $10
for one. So I reply, okay, bro, I will buy one, and if it works, I can buy more. Want to pay by Western Union, so please send details. I've come to Shoreham on the south coast to see a company who specialises in hacking. White Hat Hackers, they call themselves, as opposed to the Black Hat bad guys. One of the things they do is try to hack into the systems of companies who pay them to do this, looking for vulnerabilities. And if they can do it for companies, they can do it for individuals. So I brought my laptop with me. This is my personal laptop, not the BBC's one. BBC isn't too keen on this kind of thing. And they're going to see if they can hack into it.
Peter Wood is Chief of Operations at First Base Technologies. Before he got to work on my laptop, he made me sign a disclaimer.
So basically, what am I agreeing to here?
That we can do what you like with your laptop, basically. That we can break into it, that we can try and grab passwords from it. This is going to happen replicating, I suppose, let's say a 30-minute window where your laptop was unattended.
I have to tell you, I'm a bit nervous about this, because if you read my emails, you'll find out things about me which I wouldn't want the world to know. You're undertaking not to tell anyone.
I am, in the same way as I undertake not to tell the world what the senior people in the Bank of England are doing when I test their systems. I have selective amnesia.
So it's a bit like the confessional.
You have to trust us in the same way you trust a priest. Absolutely.
I was genuinely surprised about how vulnerable I turned out to be.
The first thing I'll do is an easy check to see whether I can get a nice little automated tool to cough up your password straight away so I can log on as you.
I'm fairly confident you're not going to get my password because it's not a natural language word.
This isn't dependent on any dictionary-based word. It's just trying every permutation of letters and numbers up to 14 characters long.
Ah. I'm feeling less confident because...
Ah, there's your password.
Oh.
That took 290 seconds of computational
that
time.
That is horrible. That is my password.
Yeah.
What could I have done to protect myself against that?
The best advice anyone can give you to protect your password on a Windows computer is to choose a passphrase of 15 characters or more. But this sort of attack is a classic attack for an unattended machine that the criminal has physical access to.
An unattended laptop is not an uncommon situation, is it?
No.
People often leave their laptops unattended.
They do. I speak at security conferences around the world on a very regular basis, perhaps one a month, and it just amazes me that at lunchtime, the majority of delegates will leave their laptops in the conference room. That's from an audience that are supposed to be switched on to these issues. And the average person really has got no idea about it at all. They'll leave them in hotel rooms, in the boots of cars, on the back seat of cars.
Given that everybody uses laptops now, what should we do? Because you don't want to carry it around with you all the time.
No,
neither do you want to leave it unattended.
No, quite. But actually there's one very easy solution, which is to implement something called full disk encryption. It's a piece of software that scrambles everything on the hard drive. That's 100% the only solution, really.
Why isn't that standard, then?
Yeah, good question. Security seems to lag behind. If the manufacturers have to build in encryption, there will be a cost associated with that for them. It'll put the price up, and they won't do that until the public really demand it.
Before I went, Peter Woods left me with a small, invisible souvenir of my visit, a so-called Trojan.
What I am going to do is attempt to introduce a piece of spyware and use it to log your activities between now and when we meet again.
You think you can?
I think I can. All I'm doing is just asking it to report to me everything you do, anything you type, any website you visit, any chat session you have.
In real life, of course, you don't need to let the hackers have physical access to your computer for them to install malware like Trojans or worms. While Peter spied on me, and while I waited on Mr. Bad Dog, I visited one of the biggest UK antivirus companies, Sophos, and spoke to Graham Cluley, senior technology consultant, and Fraser Howard, principal virus analyst.
This particular plot here, shown within Google Earth, gives us a graphical representation of one of the most infamous worms we've had recently. This is data showing Conficker infections. And each of those red pins shows a machine infected with Conficker, which the bad guys have control of.
What does this worm do?
The worm itself is quite an interesting one. The worm itself spreads and spreads voraciously. It's a bit like a sleeping giant. There's lots of machines infected with this worm. As yet, the bad guys haven't yet commanded the worm to do anything specific in terms of, for example, sending spam messages.
What did users have to do to get infected? Did you have to do something particularly stupid?
No, in the case of this particular worm, if a user was simply running their machine and the machine wasn't patched, they could be infected just through running that machine and then connected to the internet.
I think it really surprises people that, you know, we hear all the time about be careful about email attachments, be careful about website links which you click on. This worm didn't require any of that. You just had to be plugged into the internet. And if you weren't patched, because Microsoft didn't have a patch at first, then potentially the worm could come in and blast its way into your computer.
So in the latest phase of hacking, you don't have to open a dodgy attachment or download an infected program. Often nowadays, hackers work by infecting innocent websites so that when you visit them, your own computer gets infected. Spam and malware have become symbiotic. Malware is used to infect machines so that they send out spam, and spam is used to distribute links to malware-infected websites. Tracking all this criminality can take researchers across several continents.
We start seeing a spam campaign, so lots of spam messages where the spam message contains a picture of Britney and social engineering to get the recipient to click on that picture of Britney Spears to see more pictures of Britney Spears. We can see that the spam comes from a server based in Poland. And then if the victim is actually to click on this link, they get taken to a website on a server in the US. The particular webpage in question which they get shown contains a malicious script. Well, the malicious script redirects them to another server here, and this is a web server hosted in China. And this web server contains more malicious content. In this case, it's a malformed cursor file. And the payload is the download of a banking trojan from another server, this time a server hosted in Russia. And this banking malware gets silently installed on your system.
In the case of this banking trojan, it was sending it to a Brazilian Yahoo address. And all you did as a user was click on a link to watch a video of Britney Spears. You didn't see it spinning all around the world.
The other thing that strikes me is you talk about it. I'm trying to follow you, and I can sort of follow you, but it's such an esoteric world, isn't it? But the computers are bought by everybody. There's a kind of disconnect between the language which you talk about, malformed cursor files. Nobody else understands it, but we're victims of it. You know what a train robbery involves. This is a kind of crime that nobody really understands, apart from the people doing it and the people trying to catch them.
I think some of the technical complexities behind today's attacks gives us some explanation, some sort of reasoning as to why some of these attacks are so successful.
Every day, we see 20,000 new infected web pages. It's one every 4 seconds. So there's such a tidal wave of malware and cybercrime going on all the time that we can't keep up with it in terms of finding out who the culprits are. All we can do is protect our customers against it. So who knows how the police and the authorities are really supposed to crack down on it as well.
Well, in most cases they won't, says Richard Cox of Spam House, a voluntary organisation set up to fight hacking and spam. The criminals usually work by siphoning off small sums from many people's accounts.
We call it microcrime, the transactions individually small, but by the number of them, it's a very large amount.
If I went to my local police station and said, I seem to have had £10 stolen from me by credit card, what would they do?
They would simply tell you to go to your bank.
And then the bank would do its own investigation.
The bank would make up its mind whether it was worth doing an investigation.
So they might not tell the police at all?
I would say the chances are low, unless they can see a pattern which they think the police would be able to investigate.
But doesn't that mean that the investigation of this kind of crime has effectively been privatised?
Yes, absolutely. Privatised or dispensed with.
So it's quite likely there will be no investigation?
It's more than likely there will be no investigation in the majority of cases.
Message from Mr. Bad Dog. If you want buy one first, you must send money by Liberty Reserve because, that's BCOZ, I cannot go to WU Western Union office for $15. Minimum of WU is $150. Okay, so that means I need to set up a Liberty Reserve account.
The so-called carding forums, where people like Mr. Bad Dog advertise, are everywhere. You might think it's easy enough to discover who the sites are registered to, but the trail goes cold, since they're registered and paid for using the names, addresses and credit cards of other fraud victims. In the Hall of Mirrors, that's cybercrime, real people turn out to be false and false people turn out to be real. It was time to talk to Peter Wood again to see how he'd got on with hacking my very real computer.
First thing that I noticed was that you have an account with Google, which I subsequently discovered you use for your email and your calendar, and it showed me both your login name and your password.
Which was?
Frobisher.
That is correct, yes. Okay, what else?
I got a screenshot of you logging on to your bank account. I also saw you using your BBC webmail, so even though that's a very secure logon, of course it doesn't protect against someone actually taking a screenshot once you're logged in.
You saw me use my BBC email. Who was I talking to?
Someone called Sally Heaven and Beth O'D. I won't read out what you wrote in your email because it includes something that Radio 4 wouldn't want me to say.
Having got access to my email account, you probably could have done quite a lot after that, couldn't you?
Yes, in fact, just as because I have a signed consent form from you, as a demonstration, I sent you an email from yourself. I don't know whether you've seen that yet.
I did. It said, "You've been hacked."
Yes.
Well, I myself have not only been hacked, but shafted. Mr. Bad Dog has taken my $15 and disappeared without providing me with any stolen credit card details. I chased him up, and now he sent me a reply. "Man, why you reply so slow? Now UK DOB has been out of stock. I have Spain DOB, $35, and US DOB, $25. Will PM you, private mail you." I think perhaps I won't spend any more money with him.
Clearly, my attempts to buy stolen credit cards in public forums weren't likely to get anywhere. I enlisted the help of a former Scotland Yard detective, Steve Santarelli, who now works for a private security company, Team Cymru, in San Diego. According to Steve, the place to do criminal business was in an IRC chat channel. Steve sat in San Diego, and we talked via Skype as he guided me around.
So now we need to join the channel, which is nice and simple, /join.
Yep. Ah, and the screen is going crazy.
Loads of cool colours come
crazy
up.
Crazy colours and lots of ads.
So congratulations, you're now in an official underground economy IRC channel, which is entirely inhabited by criminals. And all the colours that you see scrolling up are adverts, and people put colours in them to make them stand out.
To a second, I would say, are coming past.
On the right-hand side of the screen, you can see the number of people that are in this channel.
402.
So 402 criminals are in this channel. 14 of them have OPS, OPS, which stands for operator status. Various different people have different colours next to their name. So the people with colours next to their name generally are people that have been verified. They're trusted in the community. They've got reputations to protect. So generally, you have a higher chance of success if you trade with one of these criminals.
Are any of these names here known to you?
Most of these names are very famous criminals that have been around for some time.
We chose a criminal to approach.
So your opening comment is going to be, "How much for 5 fools? So you're saying, "I want 5 credit cards, all the data that I need to cash them out."
Okay.
And so that's your opening comment. You've got to bear in mind, this guy doesn't know you. He's not going to want to have a long conversation with you.
Right.
He wants to be really sharp and punchy.
And I spell it F-U-L-L-Z in a proper criminal way.
Yeah. All in lowercase, so you're not going to capitalise. Type in, "I can buy now. What is price?" Question mark.
Oh, yeah, he's replied, "Yeah. Yeah, LR only, $40 LR.
Okay, fantastic.
That's
so
a good price, isn't it?
Give you,
and you have 5 fools. CV22, okay. Info and SSN, MMN and DOB.
We need to keep this
keep
going.
Moving, yep.
So type in ACC, space, and then the hash key, because you're asking him what is his Liberty Reserve account number.
Yep.
And then ask how soon for delivery. And then ask, "Will you replace invalid cards?"
Will, and you, I'm going to do a nice text you, replace.
You're already half criminal, John.
Yeah, I replace. He's replied, "Yeah, I replace."
Okay, fantastic.
And he's given me an account number.
Excellent.
Bro, he's called me bro. As soon as you pay $40, I start pasting instant.
The criminal was as good as his word. I sent him $40, and within a minute he supplied the names of 5 American citizens, 4 women, 1 man, complete with their credit card numbers, their dates of birth, mother's maiden names, social security numbers, phone numbers and addresses. I phoned the victims in America to check that the details were genuine. Not surprisingly, I was treated with a good deal of suspicion.
This will sound a bit strange, but I'm concerned about your credit card.
And I had to persevere.
Oh, hello, it's Jolyon Jenkins again. I'm sorry, Just bear with me for a moment and I can explain it to you.
The cards were genuine, and the people concerned had no idea they were victims of crime. But suppose I'd wanted to make money from the cards. How'd I have done it? In a London hotel, I met Israeli security consultant Uri Rivner, an expert on the systems of so-called cashing out.
You're still left with the problem of how do you actually empty the victim's account. Obviously, you won't just send it to your own bank account, which will probably means that you will have to collaborate with someone else. In the criminal lingo, it's called mule.
How are the mules recruited?
The mules are recruited via job sites. Be our regional payments officer or logistic officer or something like that. We are a company from outside of the UK, for example. We cannot open a bank account for all sorts of reasons, but we do have a lot of customers in the UK. Those customers will send you money, and then what you have to do is you have to get that money and then send it outside of the country using a kind of a wire agency.
How do they get paid?
Well, that's the thing. The mule is a victim just like anyone else in this scheme. They don't get paid. They are promised to get paid, but in reality, they never get paid. Not only that, they know that after 3-4 weeks where you don't get paid, you'll actually stop. And what they do in some of the cases, they actually do identity theft on you because they have all of your information because you applied for a job. And what they will do is they will, for example, open a new credit card on your name, so it's a kind of a double victim. You are part of a criminal operation, you never got paid, and...
There are hundreds of websites that recruit these unfortunate mules. They look like completely genuine recruitment or shipping sites. It took me just one email to one of them to be offered a job as a representative stroke bookkeeper at a salary of $3,000 a month. My job would have been to receive payment from alleged customers and send it on to an account in another country. I declined the offer, but anyone who'd just been made redundant might have been tempted. You can imagine a hierarchy of cybercrime with mules and Mr. Bad Dog somewhere near the bottom and the man who sold me the credit cards above them. Near the top, you'd find people like 76, a Russian hacker who was discovered by Don Jackson of Atlanta-based company SecureWorks. Don discovered that 76 was selling subscriptions to computers that had been infected with malware.
He said, I have a feed of data coming in, and if you want to subscribe to this stolen information, it includes everything everyone that you subscribe to's activity online, including usernames, passwords, all the sites they visited, all their banking activities.
So what exactly were you subscribing to?
Well, you were subscribing to a feed from any number of infected users, typically 100 at a time.
So he might have sold somebody a subscription to my machine. Whatever I am typing into my machine goes to the person who's bought the subscription.
That's right.
In a way, what's interesting about this is the people running the site aren't actually doing any fraud themselves. They're just selling a subscription to information that will allow other people to do fraud.
That's right. One of the key characteristics of the modern cybercrime economy is that its duties are separated. So the people installing the Trojans are not the people collecting the data. They're not the people who are aggregating and selling the data, and those people are not the ones actually cashing out. So every group makes money off the other one, and eventually the group that's actually cashing out is making money off of the victim.
So what are the police doing about all this? Well, in Britain, there have been a few arrests, mostly based on the police moving in on people operating fairly openly in carding forums. One forum was called Shadow Crew, and another was called Dark Market, which actually turned out to have been an FBI sting all along. I've come to an office block in London to meet Sharon Lemon, who heads the Serious Organised Crime Agency's e-crime unit. I've been asked not to say where their headquarters are, and to ask at reception for a fictitious company name. And when I asked the receptionist just now whether I was in the right building for that company, she said, I'm not obliged to tell you that.
14th floor. Tell me about Shadow Crew.
Okay, Shadow Crew was an online carding firm. Quite a number of the people within Shadow Crew were based in the United Kingdom.
Looking at the people who got arrested, they don't look like very serious criminals, most of them. They're people who are involved in forging driver's licences, that kind of thing.
It's funny you should say that, because that's a really common perception of e-crime, and it really irritates me, because these are serious criminals. If you ever look at Bryn Wellman, who was one of the persons prosecuted in this, had he realised the potential on the cards, it would have been millions and millions of pounds.
He was serious, yes, but quite a lot of them, I would still argue, were petty criminals.
I think this new area of criminality does attract everyone.
But I could point you to the hidden dark side of the internet, where even today, buying and selling credit cards, some of them...
Yeah, I'm very well aware of that. We decided we wouldn't do the same thing again as we did with Shadow Crew, because it displaced a lot of people that we would have liked to have kept an eye on. I do think that chasing round individuals on individual forums is not the comprehensive way forward. Our strategy is all around intervention, disruption, trying new tools and techniques, which really take the online criminal by surprise. You quite rightly say, us focusing on criminal forums here and there, we could be chasing around for the next 20 years and still not have significant impact. But if we look at the whole infrastructure of the internet and start talking to the IP registrars, when we identify IP ranges that are hosting malicious content, and say to them, well, we can actually evidence the fact that this is all malicious content, will you please take down these IP ranges? That's another opportunity for us.
In other words, the police need to go after the people who control the criminal infrastructure, the internet service providers who specialise in providing services to criminals, such as so-called bulletproof hosting, internet access that won't get shut down just because the police come knocking. One of the most notorious bits of infrastructure in recent years has been the Russian Business Network, based in an office in St. Petersburg, and which was used by the hacker 76. Richard Cox from Spam House explained how it worked.
Russian Business Network was a name given to a large collection of hosting servers where people could do whatever they wanted and without any significant interference. These are all things which are quite clearly illegal by our standards and unacceptable by any standards. But given the way they'd been set up, nobody was able to challenge what was going on there.
But what could they offer that any other internet service provider couldn't offer?
Essentially anonymity and non-traceability.
And then there's the question of where the RBN gets its access to the internet. It has to buy it from someone upstream, presumably.
We traced it to a company in Bournemouth.
In
Bournemouth, yes.
So this criminal enterprise was buying its internet connection from a company in Bournemouth.
That's right.
Did you alert anyone?
Of course. We got no replies.
What about the police?
We did contact SOCA, Serious and Organised Crime Agency, but we found ourselves talking to a brick wall. They didn't seem to understand what we were saying, and they certainly didn't respond.
Did you make it clear exactly what you were alleging?
Very clear. We were certainly aware of money laundering activity. We found this subsequently other sites in London and reported those to SOCA as well, but sadly no interest was shown.
When I spoke to Richard Cox from Spam House, he said that he'd alerted SOCA and said he'd found himself talking to a brick wall.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I didn't speak to Richard about that, and I'm not in any way challenging that he did, and that's very disappointing. But I'll certainly contact Richard to find out the story behind that.
I think what he's saying is that SOCA doesn't actually appreciate the scale of the threat.
OK.
Or have the capability to deal with it.
Well, I dispute that. It's disappointing that he feels that he can say that to you and has never approached me on that. But we're certainly engaging internationally. There's no doubt that we have a full understanding of the threat.
But criminals go to a lot of trouble to cover their tracks. According to Richard Cox, the Russian Business Network tried to make it look as if it had cut its ties with London, whereas in fact it had done nothing of the sort.
When people started asking questions, the first thing we found was that the site appeared to move to Taiwan. Unfortunately, we could also see that it hadn't moved to Taiwan.
How had they managed to make it look like it was in Taiwan when, in fact, it was still in London?
They'd put equipment in the connection chain between the internet, per se, and their equipment, which delayed the signals, which suggested the signal was passing from London to New York and then on to Taipei in Taiwan, to make the average investigator think that they were looking at a network that has moved to Taiwan and as a result is no longer within their jurisdiction.
The Russian Business Network is not the only organisation to host criminal enterprises, and not all the suspect infrastructure is in Russia. Late last year, two internet service providers based in California, Mikolo and Intercage, had to close down after allegations that they, too, were hosting criminal activity. But strikingly, it wasn't the police that got them closed down, it was the efforts of voluntary researchers, security companies and journalists. Even now, says Rick Howard of security company VeriSign, criminal infrastructure is operating with impunity.
We track some 17, 18 bulletproof hosters. They operate in the open. They claim that they are legitimate businesses, but we know that they host bad guy stuff, and none of the law enforcement agencies within those countries stop them.
Which countries are we talking about?
Most of them have no legitimate extradition treaties with the West. So we're talking about countries like Malaysia, Russian bloc countries, old Russian bloc countries. But there are two at least bulletproof hosters that operate in the U.S. that are allowed to stay open.
Still.
Even after the press has brought down Mikolo and Intercage.
Given the scale of internet crime, there are few arrests. Law enforcement seems marginalized in a fight between the private security industry and the criminals, both sides having more money to hire top talent than the police do. Steve Santarelli, who helped me buy the stolen cards, used to work for Scotland Yard until he was poached by the private sector. I put to him what seemed the most troubling aspect of my online transactions with the criminal.
This man, in his chat with me, boasts of the fact that he's been doing this for 11 years. It seems incredible that no one can stop him. He's trading completely openly.
It is a great shame, but it's a very complicated type of crime to investigate. It's actually not uncommon for more technically savvy criminals to actually elude capture for many, many years, unfortunately.
But this man has got a Liberty Reserve account. I know the number of now, I know the name of it. You'd feel there was some way of doing something, instead of which what we seem to hear from the police is, well, we're watching it, we're going to monitor it, but surely what the public wants is some arrests.
Well, I can totally understand that perspective, but from the police's perspective, it doesn't make good investigative sense to actually explain to the public exactly what is going on.
But can't we go after his Liberty Reserve account?
You certainly have the option to turn your findings over to law enforcement and see if law enforcement are in a position to take it further.
What I mean is that not an investigative route for the police?
Following the financial trail is always a good route, certainly. You have to have a cooperation from the financial institution that you're actually passing the information through, of course. And Liberty Reserve is not, as far as I'm aware, based in European jurisdiction.
No, it's based in Costa Rica. While we wait for law enforcement to catch up, there's no point in making it easier for the criminals than necessary. We need to learn to be a bit more paranoid in cyberspace, a little bit more conscious of how our virtual lives can interact with our real ones. Social networking is a case in point. Malcolm Marshall at KPMG.
Recently we worked with a major financial institution where the criminals had picked up personal information about a senior executive's family from their social networking sites. They then targeted an email to the senior executive using that information. The senior executive assumed because it had information about his family that it was from somebody he knew, clicked on the link, which then resulted in an infection into the organisation's computer systems.
Even people who should know better can be scammed, as information security researcher Nathan Hamill discovered when he tried a simple social networking stunt.
We chose a couple of different profiles to put up that were fake of famous people in the security community and then enticed other security people to link to the fake profile for this person.
Were people fooled by that?
Yes. People just wanted to connect with this person, and there were a few very high-level people in the government that connected. And in an odd twist of events, his sister actually connected with that fake profile as well. More recently, we created a fake IT recruiter and then posted fake jobs. So our goal was to see how many people with a top secret security clearance would say, hey, I'm interested in this job.
And did people with top secret security clearance sign up for a fake website?
Yes.
So what do you conclude from all this, apart from the fact that we're all idiots?
I think the awareness is down.
At the eCrime Congress, I met Chris Kelly, Chief Privacy Officer for Facebook. I wanted to ask him about the excessive trust that opens up with social networking.
People are very willing to accept others as friends who they may not know terribly well.
And we've always cautioned people against that. We think that it's important, particularly for younger users. We're asking people that they send friend requests to, do they know this person personally?
And then people are posting information on Facebook, which is the very information that can be used to compromise their bank accounts. For example, names of their pets, family names, personal details, which are the kind of stuff which has traditionally been used to prove to someone else who you are.
So the access to Facebook profiles is limited by the friends that the people accept and by the networks that they join.
But if somebody emails me through Facebook who has got my name from, say, Friends Reunited, yes, I do know them, but I don't know that that's the real person who's contacting me.
And I think that you should exercise caution.
But do you think people are aware that the person who says that they are their friends may not actually be their friends, even though they do know somebody of that name?
I think that people, just as they interact in the real world with their friends, sort of get clues over time, and if they have any suspicions that there are problems, that they should use the reporting links on the site.
The causes of cybercrime are many, but at least part of the trouble, thinks Graham Cluley of Sophos, comes down to an immature industry meeting immature minds.
A while ago, computers were only used by nerds. Computers have become consumer items, but they're not really ready for it. And I'm afraid that the typical user isn't actually capable of keeping their computers secure.
We're not ready for computers.
I don't think we are. I think we're still cavemen. I think we are still fundamentally people who, when we see a picture of Britney Spears or an offer of Angelina Jolie naked, we begin to get this little twitch in our mouse finger and we can't resist. We have to click on it, even when all the signs are there that it's going to be dangerous.
Former hacker Matthew Bevan went on to work for the IT security business, but no longer.
I've just started pulling myself out of that industry, actually, mainly because of the headaches caused from people not learning the lessons that have been around for the last 10 years. I've qualified myself as a clinical hypnotherapist, working with people's minds instead of computers.
So you became very frustrated with the way people were dealing with computer security?
Yeah, because people just don't learn the same lessons.
So do you think that the solution doesn't actually lie in there is no technical solution to this, there's only a psychological solution?
I think it's a psychological thing. I think at the end of the day, the weakness that people have against hackers, hacker techniques, criminal techniques, is a state of mind.
If you've enjoyed this programme, you might like to try other Radio 4 podcasts, from Friday Night Comedy and Daily Drama from the Archers to a range of news, discussions and documentaries. For a full list of available podcasts, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.